necessarily say they're making money per se, because some of this had, could have to do with new surplus blowing in. Yeah.
Just a quick question.
Yes.
Is it a surprise that if the you know, development goes down 12% of surplus, that their surplus goes up by 13?
Well, it may be a surprise to many, but obviously what it says is that
they just may be moving, you know, the line on their assets.
I think this is really the main answer behind that. If you look at the accident year 2004 loss ratio, overall those 30 companies are reporting a loss in LAE total loss ratio of about 66%.
Yeah.
A pretty good number by most measures.
Right.
And so in most cases we're finding is these are companies that were benefiting still from a fairly hard market in some of their commercial lines that they were writing. And they were doing fairly well on the current accident year.
Okay,
and so it wouldn't surprise most people,
yeah,
because if you conjecture that, you know, some of these companies were probably taking the hits when they could afford them.
Yeah, okay.
And that might be in asbestos, and that might be in whatever other commercial lines or construction defects, whatever the issues were. But I think this is probably the most significant finding of this process, that when they did well financially is when they tended to take the hits. Now again, there's a mixture here because some groups do look as though they can't afford, they're having to do some stress. But when we really are boiling this all down to what the outsiders are looking at, this is probably something that they may not be appreciating, that there's really a small number of companies in these large dollars of developments that are really under distress as a matter of it's getting to that original question. Are reserves taking these companies down, or are they just simply a lagging indicator of other issues? We went further, though, beyond just the basic financial data and some of the analysis of what's going on in these companies. By the way, you see lots of asbestos, AAD. I mean, that's pretty clear from the financials. And as S&P mentioned, you know, that's certainly an issue they, I guess, have in some way willing to give us a pass on. Of course, the other line was just so easy, apparently. But these, you know, those are significant impacts on the entire development chart. We also went further into looking at the opinion letters that were written by the opining actuary. And again, we had to choose the company that was the chief company of these groups. It wasn't an easy thing to do. But we got, you know, kind of dug through and found all the opinion letters. Now, actuary has been signing opinion, or sorry, have been required to comment on risk of material adverse deviation, the RMAD abbreviation there. Been required to do that since 02 or 01, so we've been looking at these, and was there a risk of material adverse deviation comment in these opinions? Now, it wasn't always easy to get some of these, but for the most part, what we're finding is that this thing has grown in percentage, but you know, when you go back, you know, barely a little more than half of the ones we were able to find here, we're showing a risk of material adverse deviation comment going back. Now, again, this is, we're focused back on the issue of public perception here. There's no way to predict conclusively that you know, whether or not there should be a risk of material adverse deviation. But using hindsight, one could say, gee, we might as a profession have been pretty slow to get moving in this area. These dollars, by pretty much any measure, over $45 billion of movement has been quite significant. And really, there's a growing percentage. We're starting to get there now, but not too often were we seeing risk material adverse deviation comments. Back to 02, what we were finding is was barely half were saying that there was a risk material adverse deviation. It does bring up a concern in terms of actuarial practice and how this requirement seems to have taken a while for organizations to get going. I know Mary Miller has commented further on this. She says, you know, overall, it started out pretty slow. We're getting better as a profession, but you know, we haven't helped the outsiders question ourselves when there aren't such disclosures in our opinion. Again, using retrospect, you can say that significant developments have happened. We also charted the AMS rating of these companies, and the last thing we looked at here was what was the employment of the person signing the opinion? Was it an employee of the organization? Was this person a independent consultant, or was it part of the audit firm, differentiating those two? And there's no intention here of trying to say, you know, okay, one is better or worse than the other. But again, dealing with public perception, is this an issue that exists significantly among one or the other? Now, it's important for me to stop here and note something. We've selected the top 30 groups, and those tend to be large companies, and those also tend to be the ones that have large actual real estate. So it's not a surprise to us that a large number, 21 or so, of these are our internal people signing up. And I wouldn't want anybody to take this as a conclusion that that's necessarily a contributing factor to reserve development. Again, it's a biased list. And in fact, what Tom's group has found out over time in looking at companies that had failed, those tended to be more often signed up by outsiders. And naturally, those tend to be smaller companies. You're not seeing as many of these huge insolvencies in the time frame he looked into. So you're seeing, I want to make sure it's clear, there's no conclusion we're making about this. We recognize the bias in the group we chose. But we want to chart this all over the industry. Yes?
I'm just looking at what you have up there, I'm noticing that of all the companies you have listed, there was no negative growth in surplus by an opinion signed by an employee.
Okay. Probably noticing something I haven't looked at. That is, okay. You're right. Well, there's what? There's some down here. There's some negative surplus here. I guess this one. No, I'm looking at the wrong one. Right?
Yeah.
All right. Good point. I don't know that if that brings us to any particular conclusion, but similar to what Tom's looking at, I mean, there may be a tendency. I would guess that some of these companies, in fact, we know by examination, some of these companies that have negative surplus growth, reductions in surplus, have been distressed. Perhaps there is a greater need to get independent in there. It might not be one is causing the other. It might be just that they're going to independent sources because they might be under a triangular exam. It might be under a financial examination. A lot of times that spurs getting outside of the community. Yes?
So to try to restate what I thought you just said is that when we think about the companies that went insolvent, mm-hmm. we tend to think about those as being smaller companies. The ones that are contributing the most to the adverse development of dollars is the larger companies. And I think it may be a thing to think about is that there may be a large disconnect between those two concepts. What's going on is, what's driving industry dollars and insolvencies if it tends to be two different groups.
Yeah, it's a valid point. The $45 billion you've seen over 3 years. I don't know of those dollars how many companies, have really gone down as a result of it. But it's a small portion of those dollars, I would that have actually resulted in insolvencies. Again, a lot of these organizations are still around. All right, well, this is an important foundation for our research, and so we continue to look at this as well as we've built an opinion database internally that looks at all the companies and so attaches some data about the opinions. And again, the purpose is simply as an academy to understand what the issues really are and to understand where, in terms of actuarial practice, we need to be continuing to examine. It's not in any way to try to set anything or anybody up as much as to make sure we can continue in our role as educators to the profession or to the outsiders, as educators on behalf of the profession, what the issues are. As I mentioned, a lot of what I'm going to go through here is a summary of what we just shared, so some of it might be repetitive. Now, what we found was about 35 to 40% was asbestos related. 40% of the developments were related to reinsurance and excess casualty high layer stuff. 30% was unique sources of med mal, mold, workers' comp. And by the way, I'm recognizing that those add up to more than 100%, and there's naturally some overlap, so it wasn't like these are mutually exclusive groups. It was probably the best way to describe what we see in terms of billions of dollars in development can be attributed in some way this way. So it's not just asbestos environmental. And again, John's shown you indications that the industry continues to be anywhere from 30 to 50 billion deficient, excluding asbestos. And so that is, it continues to be an ongoing concern. But going back, it's really an important aspect of this. So much of that was asbestos as well, I mean, very little. Or environmental material. The big question is, does anybody really think those have gone away or are they just taking a vacation right now? As I mentioned, the surplus grew significantly over that time. That was the point that Glenn had focused on. Overall, risk material adverse deviation, not just on the 30 companies, but in the groups we looked at, we concluded approximately 50%. Again, I showed you 9 of 14. I think I'd updated that chart. It was close to about 50% had risk. That percentage is growing, and I would 5, but it'll continue to grow among the 30 groups that we look at. 80% were employees, again, not in any way to suggest that that's the reason as much as it's related to the size of the companies. But if you look at the notes about the A&E reserves, overall we found only about 10% of these reserves related to these groups are related to A&E. And again, if you look at the history of the developments being 30 to 40% of overall reserves, it does give you a very high level concern about it. Are these things up to snuff, or are they, the 10% of the overall reserves going to continue to show adverse development in the asbestos environmental? Well, obviously, the basement cushions, there's not one or two factors. You're not just talking about it's just an asbestos problem, or it's just a construction defect problem, or it's just a vent melt problem. It's a problem in a lot of different places. Public perception boils down to what management's role is versus the actuary's role, what the responsibilities are of each organization, as we just showed you. Surplus grows significantly over time. Some of that is capital infusion, but some of it has to do with some pretty nice loss ratios. Is this really a matter of management taking the responsibility of taking the hit when it can't afford to, as a lot of people would conjecture from that data? And what's the actuary's responsibility in doing their job? Now, a lot of that has been outlined by the task force and their 6 recommendations. It goes a long way now to separate out what the duties of the actuary are versus management. At least disclose moves toward transparency of who is who. Now, again, S&P came along and said they're all conspiring together. Well, you know, if we really believe in our educational mission, I think those 6 recommendations are very helpful in making it clear what our role is and what we're saying. We can't get too caught up in hiding in what they would have called, what they did call the reserving ruse and a conspiracy. Simply, let's disclose what it is we're doing and why we're doing it. And I think in the long run, we can only be better off. What's next? Well, you know, there's a lot of causes for optimism, honestly. And underwriting results have been pretty good over the last few years. And are reserves more adequate? Are the asbestos reserves we saw people taking a hit, are they up to some degree of adequacy? Who knows? There's also a lot of reasons for pessimism. Reserve developments show no signs of or no signs of going away. They've gotten a little softer than before. Markets in many areas are softening. Price competition is coming back significantly in certain commercial lines. And as I mentioned before, environmental impairment liability. We see major developments in these reserves, as we show you A&E, because that's how they get reported. Pretty much all that stuff is asbestos. Are environmental reserves going away? Is there any reason to believe they're going away, or do they have to do just simply with emphasis points? And a lot of people have noted low staffing levels at the EPA. Republican administration are probably one reason why that's been put on the back burner for a lot. But is there any reason to think they've gone away? That's a real concern for a lot of people in the industry. So we could be speaking more about environmental developments as well. The issues that they're going next that are important for us to focus on in the future, a lot has been said about, again, I'll go to Mary Miller's comments yesterday, getting away from the result signing off on the reserves simply as a matter of are we in the range, good, we'll worry about it next.